long 2 days.
In fact, it's been a long year. And as we proceed, I was trying to decide for myself up to this morning whether I was going to make a contribution to this debate. That question which I asked myself really revolved around my own thoughts about the budget. It was a comprehensive budget. A budget which took into account much of what is required to deal with the ills that affect this country, especially that which affects us, over which we have no control. But finally this morning, mid-morning, I decided to put pen to paper and to put something together so as to support members on this side of the House and to lend my voice to this debate. I have a tremendous amount of confidence in the people of this country, Mr. Speaker. I believe that the people of St. Lucia are smarter than some people think. I believe the people of St. Lucia can analyze and can make decisions for themselves. Too often we've heard persons talk about fooling all of the people, some of the time. Fooling some of the people, all of the time. Because some of them get fooled all the time. Because they are poisoned by a certain level of subjectivity and loyalty. But I know for a fact, based on the results of the last general election, that you can't fool all the people all the time. And so when I sit here today, perhaps my contribution will be somewhat different. My contribution will tend to be more middle of the road, because I believe the time has come when some of us must set an example. Some of us must demonstrate that the coming together of our people begins here in this honorable house. And I believe that as I listen to the contributions of members on both sides of this honorable house, and in most cases the underlying theme has been one-upmanship on matters relating to past governance, finger-pointing, and rationalization of past failures. The truth is, and it's a simple truth, yet an inescapable truth, a global reality which applies across the board, and that is that no government ever achieves all that it sets out to do in the interest of its people. There's no government that has done it. I believe that there is an honest intention to do it. I believe most people intend to. They'd like to do it. But if we're going to be honest with the people of St. Lucia, we must say that we're like a small raft being tossed around in the ocean of globalization. And there's nothing worse in a situation like that than having people in the raft fighting with each other. Because in the final analysis, we'll never get to shore. We're going to sink the ship. Mr. Speaker, we have in the last few days heard, by way of example, of the landslide victory which Jacob Zuma managed to realize in Africa, in South Africa. And he managed to do this amid some rather sordid details about his personal life. Details concerning graft and corruption, and even a charge of rape. He overcame all of that, and today stands as the president-elect of South Africa. Yet the bigger issue has to be the failure of the African National Congress to bring a greater measure of relief to the desperately poor people in the townships and ghettos of South Africa. most of whom are still without electricity and running water. In what is in fact the wealthiest and most powerful country on the African continent. Dare we in this chamber say that this is a failure of the much vaunted benefactors from the party of the legendary Nelson Mandela. Dare we say that? Closer to home, there have been ambitious pronouncements on both sides. Falling highways by members opposite, and in the case of this government, a budget last year which so obviously overstepped the boundaries of achievability as to attract derision and a spare share of ridicule from members opposite. But this is a new day, and in the past year, reality has hit its target. Clearly, members on both sides agree on one thing. All of us agree. We've heard it here all day. There is but one common thread that runs through this honorable house. And it is upon that thread of reality that the short to medium term hopes of this country is suspended. Everyone here is united in our agreement. There is consensus that this is a global economy in which we exist. We are part of this global economy. And quite frankly, things are bad. Really, really bad in this economy. Members opposite, for their own purposes, they propose that the advent of 9/11 caused greater economic dislocation than we are experiencing at present. But if you are friends of the truth and not colored with subjectivity, the only reality is that this situation we are faced with now is far, far worse than 9/11. My friends, honorable members, seasoned economists at this particular point in time cannot even come up with answers. The data does not support any conclusions which you can say or deliver with any level of confidence. This is how bad things are in the world today. It's not a question of incompetence. It's not a question of an inability on the part of government. It is that this government is facing considerable headwinds. This situation is unprecedented. So where do we go from here? We have moved from a financial crisis to an economic crisis. And if you paid attention to the news today, you will understand that we may very well be moving back to a financial crisis simply because Citibank and Bank of America are required quite possibly to raise even more capital after having received billions of dollars and as much as $108 billion in the case of Citibank in terms of guarantees from the government of the United States. And I'm going to tell you in due course how all of this is going to affect us here in Sedusha, how we must prepare for it, how we must put our shock absorbers, as the member for Labrie spoke about. It was interesting to hear him talk about shock absorbers, because I think the biggest shock absorber in the history of St. Lucia was the shock absorber that was there when the Labour Party got into power in 1997. It was a shock absorber of low debt, which we don't have the pleasure of having now. But I'm not here casting aspersions. I want us to understand that insofar as this crisis is concerned, you will have to understand the realities of it and why it's affecting us in the way that it is. And I expect now and later I can begin to show how perhaps we can soften the blow to some extent. Mr. Speaker, the beginning of the financial crisis in the United States, I'll give a brief summary of it, because I think it's important for honorable members to get a grip of this. This financial crisis emanated from greed on the part of bankers in the United States. It was a clear situation where people took loans to buy houses. Persons who didn't even qualify for loans. I understand even Mexicans crossed the border into the United States were illegal aliens at the time and still managed to get credit to buy a house which was far more expensive than they could afford. And what the banks did, the investment banks did, was they took all these loans and they packaged them into securities, mortgage-backed securities, and sold these financial instruments to pension funds and mutual funds and other large organizations to the tune of trillions of dollars. And of course, when the banks sold the mortgages, then they got fresh capital which they turned around and loaned. And companies like Countrywide Financial and so on made billions and billions of dollars. And of course, people wanted to buy houses because house prices were going up by as much as 10% a year in most states. So if you bought a house for $100,000 this year, the likelihood is that next year it will be worth $110,000. And the following year it will be worth $120,000 or $130,000. So then you can go back to the bank and take an equity loan, which is called equity financing. So you owed $100,000, it was worth $130,000, you could then go and take another $20,000 to buy a boat, to buy a new car. And so there was a tremendous amount of activity in the global economy. Factories were running. People were having vacations. They had so much disposable income, it was crazy. People were buying second homes. And hence you saw a build-up in the development of second homes here in St. Lucia. You saw companies racing with each other to come to St. Lucia to build condos and to build villas and so on, which they would sell for hundreds of thousands of US dollars and make tremendous profits. All of this spurring the economy, creating jobs, and making St. Lucia more and more attractive as it did other islands in this hemisphere. But all of it came crashing down because all of a sudden it reached a peak. And some of these people, the homes weren't going up in value anymore. People were refusing to pay that amount. And so the persons whose value was going up when they could take equity and pay the mortgage, or they took some creative financing whereby you paid nothing but interest for 5 years and so on, all of that stuff started to come home to roost. And it started to unravel, and it started to unravel fast. And now, what has happened? Now, these banks are in trouble. So they have a whole bunch of loans on their books that nobody's paying. So what happened now? The bank is preserving its capital. And so no money is being loaned out. There's what's called a credit crunch or credit freeze. So nobody has money. You can't borrow money. Businesses don't have money. People aren't buying second homes. People aren't buying condos. People aren't buying villas. People aren't taking vacations. They're not flying. And this is what has put us in the situation that we're in. I mean, let's be honest about it. Let's not play politics with it. This is why we are where we are today. And we've been vilified by members opposite, and some people say it's their job to do that. But it was somewhat, to my mind, disingenuous of the leader of the opposition to talk about coming together. From the time we got into power, the first words emanating from the Labour Party was that we were going to take back our country. I mean, it started the tone for there to be controversy and for there to be rivalry. It started it. That's where it came from. We're taking back our country with little regard for the mandate that was given by the electorate. I mean, we don't take back countries. That's the talk of revolutionaries. We go to the ballot box. We convince people of the value of our proposals. And clearly we did an excellent job of it because we're sitting here today. But there's something in this world called acceptance. And if you can't accept the reality, you are doomed to fight it. And so we've been fighting. Mr. Speaker, I want to deal, having dealt with what has caused us to get where we are, I want to try and exhibit a measure of statesmanship. I want to look at the leader of the opposition, Mr. Speaker, a man who has told the country in recent times that he's ready to govern, he's ready to lead. I have no doubt that he thinks he is. Amen. We're all subject to our fanciful delusions. The Lord can't deny us that, and no one on this side of the house will deny anybody that. But is he really ready to lead? That's an important question. The solutions must ask themselves that question. I mean, let's be generous. In fact, no, let's be fair. There were headwinds which confronted the government of the Labour Party back in 1997 when they got into power. That's the reality. And let me say from the outset that I want to be fair, because I believe in the ability of the St. Lucian people to judge what I'm saying and to decide for themselves whether it holds muster or not. The global economy was going through a major shift. We were moving from an era of tariff protections. We were moving from an era where we had preferential treatment in markets for our exports. We were moving from an era where people saw us still in a colonial light, and there were numerous loans available for our development. And we're moving into an era of globalization. And we were told that we had to adjust to that globalization. We had to prepare to strike out on our own. And in striking out on our own, we had to adjust our economies accordingly. But it did not start with the Labour Party in 1997. It started 3 years earlier with the advent of Sir John Compton. You recall Sir John running up and down to Europe and to the United Kingdom, trying his best to secure our markets, trying his best to ensure that he could stretch out the period of preferential treatment for as long as possible. And what was going on at home? At home, there were banana strikes. There were banana farmers cutting other farmers' bananas. There was coupe par coupe, burning down of sheds. Everything to disrupt a vital industry at a time when the country could least afford it. And who was behind it? Who was behind it? Persons with all sorts of hidden political agendas. Persons who did not care about St. Lucia, no matter what they say, when they find it necessary to engage in nationalistic masturbation. They were behind it. They were hired hands of the multinationals. There were threats, from what I understand, to blow up bridges. In fact, a member on this side of this house famously said that he was contacted on the matter. But there is an eerie similarity between what occurred then and what is occurring now. Because at the time, the catalyst for action was: give the banana farmers their industry, pay down their debt, help the farmers do this and do that. And so the people were mobilized into action, thinking of their own interests and believing in the persons who were leading them. But the real objective was to bring down the government. That was the real objective behind that. But what's going on today? Today we're going through a measure of industrial action. Nobody in this government has ever repudiated or spoken of denying the teachers of this country of their just deserts. You know how hard teachers work, some of them. I don't think anybody would begrudge me for saying not all of them. We have cases and examples of people who are teachers who shouldn't be teachers. That's a reality. But most of them, the overwhelming majority of them, are hardworking, dedicated people, committed to the welfare of the students in their charge. Dipping their hands in their pockets to help students. I mean, you'd be heartless to see a kid come into school every day and not having anything to eat and not go and buy them something. You know. Doing all of that. There are other civil servants. Good people. Sometimes I think a lot of them can be better if we directed them properly. But they're again being catalyzed by a desire to have the Prime Minister pay what is due. I agree. It's due. The Prime Minister did, in fact, say that he was going to give that unprecedented increase. Unprecedented. But I think the Prime Minister, like most people, miscalculated the severity of the global economic downturn. He miscalculated it. And I believe that having miscalculated it, when the time came to sit with his technocrats and prepare the budget, it was clear that there was such a large deficit in funding that it had to come from somewhere. Deficits change, Mr. Leader of the Opposition, because deficits change. Because deficits change according to where and how you chop and change. The Leader of the Opposition was the Minister of Finance. He knows these things. So what are we dealing with? Are we dealing with a situation where those teachers and civil servants, police, etc., etc., are unreasonable people? I don't think they are. Neither were the banana farmers. They're not unreasonable people. They are patriotic solutions. I believe that. But the reality is, they are being spurred on. In the same way the banana farmers were being spurred on, they are being spurred on. History is repeating itself. The objective has less to do with teachers, civil servant salaries, and more to do with politics. There are persons meeting on a regular basis, politicians, with the leadership of the union. That's a fact. And so, what are we doing? Like that period before, when we had the banana situation, history repeats itself once again. And the objective is to bring down a government. But what happened when the government was brought down the last time? All of a sudden everybody got in and realized that governance is not as easy as they thought. That the management of an economy is not as easy. They realized that perhaps then as now, all of the things that are impacting on our economy and which causes for a period of consolidation and working together in order to ease us out of those situations. They realized that it wasn't that easy. And it won't be easy this time either. Because what we need at this point in time is understanding, consolidation, working together, coming together in an atmosphere of mutual respect and trust. That's what we need. Bringing government down is not a solution. It can only add to our problems. We need industrial peace and tranquility. So what happened? Having gotten into power and facing all those difficulties, start borrowing. Because we had to put up a good front at the time. Members opposite couldn't very well get into power, and things were worse than they were before they assumed the leadership of the country. So, after a man who was prudent in the manner in which he dealt with the country, so much so that there is this myth going around. Dr. John once said that you can put a gun to my head, I'm not giving you any money. Sir John never said that. Sir John said, if I have $5 and you ask me for $10, you can put a gun to my head, I can't give you $10. But of course, it's politics. So we turn it around and make it sound good so we can inflame people's emotions. But what I am saying to you is that this is dangerous. This is not a time for this sort of activity. And history repeating itself can only drag us further down the road of unmanageable debt. That's all it will do. And so we need to be patriotic, all of us. St. Lucia never asked anybody to give their life for the country, as they do in the United States and other places. But what we do ask for on occasion is a little patience, a little understanding. And we're not doing it arrogantly, or with a lack of emotion, or with a lack of understanding. But we're saying, let's work together. Let's see how we can cooperate for the good of St. Lucia. Mr. Speaker, I only hope that the caveat on what it is that I have brought here in an attempt to demonstrate what I believe is occurring, and which is extremely dangerous. You know, a lot of union leaders, and I know they're sensitive people sometimes, but a lot of them have shown political colors over the years. They have. It's a reality. So we need to deal with that from the point of view of understanding it and seeing where we go. I remember Von Lewis saying on a political platform one time that Sir John handed him a platter of poison fruit. And I think he called it poison fruit because he felt that at the time that he was given the country, it had been brought to its knees by members opposite, and there is nothing that he could have done in terms of resuscitating it. But we have to now move forward and see what we can do. Mr. Speaker, there has been a very strong global response to this crisis. The G8, group of eight, the G20, as it constantly expands, because more countries seem to be coming into that economic club of wealthy nations, have put forward unprecedented stimulus packages to try and spur economic growth. You will notice that there's both monetary and fiscal stimulus that has been put out there in the world. There's been sharp reductions in interest rates. In the United States, the interest rate is now 0.5%. Other countries, from Australia to the United Kingdom, are constantly reducing their interest rates. And of course, as countries reduce their interest rates, the United States, having taken the lead and gone ahead with the chairman of the Federal Reserve slashing interest rates to a large extent, what have we noticed has happened? The US dollar has appreciated in value. And of course, as the US dollar appreciates in value, it causes even more hardship on St. Lucia. Because one, since it's worth more than the pound, and we're pegged against the pound, against the dollar, our banana farmers get less money for their fruit. In addition to that, while vacations to England and visiting our friends in the UK and so on is cheaper, but when they repatriate money to St. Lucia for their families, they get less money. So there's less money to spend. I mean, these are the realities. It has nothing to do with mismanagement. It has nothing to do with a failure of a government to take responsibility for its actions. These are things that affect countries, and there is very little we can do about it. We don't control which way the US dollar goes versus currency around the world. Another manner in which it affects them is the fact that persons who are going out there
And, you know, members opposite should know something about currencies. Because when they took some of their loans in foreign currencies and it changed, we ended up owing more money than we did if they had done it in US dollars. So, this is nothing strange. And I know they know what I'm talking about. But in addition to that, you have a situation where the sale of condos, the sale of villas, the sale of land, the sale of homes, you realize in a short space of time the value of everything in St. Lucia shot up. Land that was valued at 10 EC dollars in Capital State all of a sudden was 25 US, at 30 US. St. Lucians couldn't buy anything because the pound was so high. And there was so much money floating around that people could come here and buy this stuff. It was nothing. But today, someone who had indicated an interest in buying a villa, say for 600, 700, or shall we say for $1 million, if that same person had to come and buy it today and had to convert pounds to US dollars, they would have to pay about 1.4 million for the same thing because of the difference in the currency. So what has happened? A lot of the projects that were expected to come on stream did not come on stream. There was no financing available. There's a credit crunch. Who's going to lend you money to build a project or to develop a project when nobody's out there to buy it? People who have homes in the United States, you know, if you go to Florida now, you can buy something for nothing. 40% of the homes there are on the market. Prices are falling dramatically, anywhere from 30 to 60%. In the vaunted economic capital of the world, the United States of America, the president has put in trillions of dollars to try and avert economic collapse, a complete collapse of the system. And in St. Lucia, what are we doing? Rather than recognize the realities that confront us, we want to go and incite people to strike for money that they're going to get anyway. For what? What's that doing to us? The distraction, etc. I mean, I don't like using that term. I mean, that makes me sound like a terrorist. No. We understand these things. And as I appeal to the people of this country, let's forget about all the backstabbing and all the talk about tear gas back in time before most children here were born, and bloodshot eyes. They're not bloodshot, but bloody eyes. And all this sort of thing to, again, incite emotions and spur people to want to get agitated at a time when we should be calm, reserved, circumspect, and very cautious about the actions that we take. Madam Speaker, you know, there's something called systemic risk. And because of the risk to the system, we're really in survival mode in most of the world today. There's also been a crisis of confidence. But they're saying that crisis has a double meaning. It can mean extreme pressure. Fannie Lou Hamer pressure. But it can also mean exciting possibilities. So what are we going to focus on? The pressure or the possibilities? There are exciting possibilities for St. Lucia. There are exciting possibilities for the people of this country. I want to warn you, because I think a year ago I gave you a fair idea of where it was going. And I'm going to tell you now that with all the money being pumped into the global financial system, I doubt Mr. Bernanke can pull it out, fast enough, raising interest rates. So you can expect, might be 2 years from now, I don't know, but you can expect that US dollar is going to die sometime. So it would be a good idea
to have less money in cash and more money in hard assets. Whether it's gold, whether it's property, whether it's houses, value is going to go up again. The Americans have a term they use now that they are green shoots of prosperity beginning to emerge. I don't believe that. I believe we've got another dose of downward pressure before we see the global economy begin to recover. But what kind of recovery can we expect? Can we expect a V-shaped recovery where everything goes down and then shoots back up? Can we expect a U-shaped recovery where it goes down, it stays down there for a while, and then it shoots back up? Or can we expect an L-shaped level of really anemic growth, where things just basically just go along, but nothing major happens? Well, as a government, we have to prepare ourselves for that. And I think the Prime Minister, when he spoke in terms of generating growth, I believe he's on the right track. Our growth doesn't mean 7%. But what it does mean is that we're not going to be stagnant in our economy. Securing jobs. Well, that's what we're trying to do. Because you don't want people being out of work. Already we know that with what's going on, as I've explained earlier, it's virtually impossible to prevent layoffs, especially in the tourist industry. It's not very difficult to stop it. I mean, even when the hotels are running an 80% occupancy, we know what they're doing. We know that they have to cut or give major rebates and discounts in order to get the people here. And we're competing with everybody else in that regard. And while we're talking about that sort of thing, let me say that it's heartening when we hear good proposals coming from members opposite. And I can think of three. I think the member of Kashi South spoke about 150 hours of national service as a component of the graduation process or for qualifying for graduation. Excellent idea. Something that we need to take on board. This government is not about shutting out our opposition. We welcome good ideas. We welcome contributions that can make a difference, that can help us. Because we don't have any exclusivity or monopoly when it comes to ideas. We never claim to have it. But we welcome ideas. We welcome the idea from the leader of the opposition, in that we have to revisit the whole question of taxes on dividends and, and interest. We need to revisit it. I don't know if he's right, but certainly he presented a compelling argument as to why we need to revisit it. And I think we do. So perhaps if persons who know better than we do, or have more experience in that area, can go and take the time to advise us properly. Although the advice did come from people whom we trust. But nonetheless, perhaps we need to expand it. And that's what compelling arguments are about. And this is what a budget debate ought to be about. Not about ancient history and attacks and vilification and, you know, finger pointing and all that sort of thing. Just deal with the structure of the budget.
Mr. Speaker, I'm so happy to see the Prime Minister. Glad that the Prime Minister came in to hear part of my presentation. I want to put the Prime Minister at ease and to let him know how satisfied I am with this budget, and to let him know how realistic this budget is. And let me say that the language that was used in the budget is something that we must pay attention to, because too often someone may say something to the effect that it is our intention to, and we expect to, and somebody treat it as some sort of factual stating. We will. It is an intention. That's what the budget is. This is what we intend to do. But certainly the idea that was brought forward by the leader of the opposition is something that I would certainly compliment him on and thank him for at least helping to point us in the right direction. The member for Labrie spoke about airports. I've always been one of those who feels that we only need one airport. I know that the Minister of Communications and Works has commissioned a study, and he has a report in his possession. I haven't seen it.
Perhaps there's something I don't know about airports. I'm not an expert on airports. So maybe I'll find out that there's a perfectly good reason for having two. But my own logic tells me that one makes more sense. See, I'm a logical guy. So we welcome those sort of ideas. And I hope that we can have more of it. Constructive criticism. That's what he means. That's what St. Lucia means. That's what men of goodwill, cooperation, and intent do. But of course, with all of the good things that the Prime Minister and Minister of Finance has put in his estimates of revenue and expenditure, and the basic policies that he has outlined moving forward, policies which were outlined not in isolation or in some back room, but something that was done collectively. There was a tremendous amount of collaboration in putting this together. And for me, at this point in time, the major task for this government is implementation. And it's a word that's been bandied around all the time. Implementation, implementation. But you know, there are people who are not interested in implementation. You know, one of our top publishers in this country, very famous man, not only in St. Lucia, but all over the world, goes by the name of Rick Wayne. He wrote an article recently and said that opposition people are interested in chaos. You know, without chaos, they have no use. If everything is going well in the country, everybody is happy, there's progress, they have no chance of getting in power. See, they're less interested in how well the country does and more interested in it doing bad enough for them to get it. But they never seem to realize that if it's doing badly, then they inherit a mess. And so I prefer to see an opposition that is going to win me over with the value of its ideas, the strength of its arguments, the validity of its proposals. This is what we want to see. Don't try and knock us down and bring the country to a grinding halt in order to get into power. That's not what it's about. Come with good suggestions, like the tax suggestion, or the airport, or 150 hours of community service. Solutions will respond to that. I've always said that there is no solution that is segmented and specific that will solve the problems of this country. None. But together, government, opposition, church, clubs, mothers and fathers groups, everybody working together, we have a chance. We have a chance. But sometimes we're too happy. You know, we this is the Lucia where we're happy. Very often when I go in my constituency, some people tell me, you know, what's the problem all about? You know, we're doing quite well in St. Lucia in spite of all of the problems. I mean, the Prime Minister outlined, for example, what the debt situation is. And I think the bogey of the debt and borrowing has to be dismantled. We have to exorcise that ghost. Of course you have to borrow. Every government must borrow. Businesses borrow. People borrow. You borrowed. We'll borrow. But we intend to borrow quite a bit this year. There's no secret. You have to borrow. Things are going rough, you go and take a loan. You go to the credit union. You might even go to your partner down the road and ask him to hand you a couple of dollars till tomorrow. Sometimes you need a little money to tide you over. Or you may have an emergency. Your country is facing an emergency. The world is facing an emergency. It's a crisis. So we must borrow. The problem has never been the borrowing. And I heard the member for Sufre talking about good borrowing, productive borrowing. You know? Well, look, I'll tell you something. The member of Sufre is an intelligent man. The value of some of his contributions, if you listen carefully, are quite solid. Of course, there's a spirit and an air of buffoonery in his delivery. But he's a smart guy. You know, I mean, just the way he comes across. So let's not be too critical of him. If you listen to him carefully, he makes some good points. I wouldn't mind having him on my side. And I understand that might not be too far away. Because he and the leader of the opposition, they don't see eye to eye on too many things, from what I was told. But the reality is that we need to exercise the ghost of borrowing. We need to make everyone understand. And we need to accept that borrowing is a fact of life. But of course, when you borrow, all of a sudden, your obligations, the manner in which you conduct your business, assumes a greater level of importance. Because you can't tell me you're going to borrow money from somebody. You come to me and tell me things are rough, loan you $500, and when I give you the $500, I see you by, you know, some nightclub having a good time. I see you buying $1 million worth of beer. $3 million. Or $1 million worth of toilet paper. $2 million. I mean, if you borrow and that's what you do, I have a problem with your borrowing. I mean, when you borrow, you want to know that you see the fella eating dry bread, but he's telling you, look, I'm going through this period because I intend to pay you back. But he's not paying back. We have to pay back. Future generations of St. Lucians have to pay back. That is the reality. So we have transferred that burden from the persons who borrowed and bought beer and toilet paper with the money to future generations of St. Lucia. So who's mortgaging the future of St. Lucia? Who's talking about what is going on with our people? Who's talking about having an interest in the poor man in St. Lucia? It's sectoral and personal interests. These are the interests we hear about. And then they're selective, members opposite, in the manner in which they attempt to vilify you. I remember yesterday, the member for Soufre was talking about Bouton. Talking about how they built a road to Bouton, when the UWP never did it, and all this sort of thing. You know, in Bouton, Bouton is a traditional Labour Party stronghold. There are very few people who live there. But the United Workers' Party, being the caring, sympathetic government that it is, and recognizing that the children of Bouton, because Sir John was high on education, that the only way these children could go to school was if the parents knew people in Soufre, because there's no way a child could walk from Bouton to Soufre in the morning and walk back home. Talking about,
I remember you have 15 more minutes.
Madam Speaker, I wish to invoke a suspension of Standing Order 3210 and to permit the member for Suzelle a further 60 minutes to complete his contribution to this Honourable House.
Honourable Member, the question is that Standing Order 3210 be invoked to allow Honourable Member from Suzelle an additional 60 minutes to complete his contribution. I now put the question, as many as are of that opinion, say aye.
Aye.
As many as are of a contrary opinion, say no. I think the ayes have it. The ayes have it. Member, proceed.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. The question of Bouton. Bouton is a nice place, I'll tell you. I've been there. I don't know how many of you have been there, but it's a really nice place. Nice people. But a small head school was built in Bouton to facilitate the kids there. This was done by the United Workers' Party government. Although Bouton has always been a stronghold of the Labour Party. But that's not what's important. When the member spoke about the $1 million that was spent, I said, for 20 people. And I was vilified by members opposite. Oh, that's what you all think about poor people and so on and so forth. You know, in the last election, the Labour Party got 47 votes in Bhutan. and the United Workers Party got 12. So the way I see it, the Labour Party paid $31 million for 35 votes. That's how I see it. Because you cannot tell me that all of the other communities in this country, where there are hundreds of people, hundreds of homes, who have never seen a paved road, that that is where you decided to go. So your development philosophy is based more on political gains and political criteria than it is on what is in the best interest, because that is the central theme and responsibility of any government. When you spend the money of the people, you spend it so that the benefit can accrue to the largest number of people. You don't want to spend $1 million for 50 people when that same $1 million could facilitate 2,000 people, no matter what. I have a community in my constituency, Parker State, Kayabwa, Honorable Leader of the Opposition, a place you know well. I thought I'd elicit a knowing smile, but clearly not. The road, horrendous. There are more houses there. There are more people there. Many of them related to the Leader of the Opposition. The road wasn't put there. Forget about the fact that they were related. But we're talking about numbers. So it's not anything that I have against poor people of Bhutto. I'm simply saying that what impacted on that decision was politics, plain and simple. And that's a wrong example to send forth. Again, we went to the NDC, and the member for Beaufort South and Leader of the Opposition spoke about the patrimony of the Beaufort people. That the land in Beaufort belongs to Beaufort people. Well, I would concede that Beaufort people have, I suppose, first choice or something of that nature. But the land in St. Lucia belongs to St. Lucia. We don't divide our people that way. But if he's correct about that, I would submit that the PI lands belong to the PI people. And when the PI lands were sold at $1 a square foot, there's a lot more to that, but I won't go into it. But they were sold for $1 a square foot to people who had been living on that land. Most of it was not bought by people from there. Those who were already there on lots and so on and their homes, they bought. But what was free did not go to the PIP. But worse, this was done hurriedly before the last general elections. And the $1 a square foot did not meet the cost of infrastructure. So what do you have now? You have a mess. Roads going all over the place, passing in front, some behind. Water system in disarray. Who inherited the mess? Who do you think the people coming behind to fix it? Mr. Leader of the Opposition. Madam Speaker, through you. I ask you, motivated once again by political considerations. So there seems to be a dichotomy, a contradiction in the policies that we get. But if we deal with NDC, let's deal with the reality. The Leader of the Opposition was then the Prime Minister of St. Lucia. He is the district rep of Beaufort South. And he was also the Minister for the NDC. Now in a situation like that, you don't have too many places to hide when a constituent goes and just plunks down his house anywhere on government land. And it seems logical to me that the leader of the opposition, as a district rep, prime minister and minister of NDC, would have a difficult time kicking voters off land. Because every time you kick a voter off the land, that's a vote you lost. And the family. It was during this period of time, knowing what they know, that you have the greatest level of squatting, disorganized, plucking down of houses all over the place. It was like Mia La Vibo Devo. Everybody was out there doing their thing. That's what you had.
Girl.
And today, we have to deal with it. And the leader of the opposition comes out and says, people were there for 20 and 30 years. They have to now get an agreement with NDC before they can get a water connection. Look at me, you're there for 20, 30 years without a water connection. I mean, come on. The fact is, if somebody goes and plunks themselves down on the land, you are asked to come in and rationalize or regularize your tenancy on this land in an effort to get this thing. I can only go by what you say. Well, I know a lot more than you think. Alright? So this is what we're dealing with. And so we're now trying to deal with a situation where we can get a lot of these lands, a lot of people to own their lands, sell it to people, get people organized. And I think generally speaking, while you might talk about Opikan lands for $9, we're not selling it for $1 because we want to put in the infrastructure. And that's the difference between that and TI. That's the difference between that and TI, where you sell lands and you don't put any infrastructure. There's even a story, I have yet to substantiate it, but I think it's worth listening to, where a development was put down for people from the Bruceville area to move them and to give them ownership of land. And these people were given the lands by the government in order to encourage them to move, the then government. And they moved to the lands that they were given free. And after they got their land papers, they sold the land and went back to squat in Bruceville.
I don't see you on a
These are the points of order.
These are the policies.
On a point of order, I was really hoping, Madam Speaker, that the minister would have spoken uninterrupted. But what he just said is not true. Nobody was shifted from Bruceville on that basis. About 10 or 12 households were shifted from Bruceville to make way for a huge drain to cure the problem of drainage. And because of the construction of the drain, which was in the path of some households, they were moved. That's all there is to it. So what she said is absolutely untrue. It's a lie.
And the leader of opposition, you stood on a point of clarification, not a point of... Well,
on a point of misleading the House, but if you want further elucidation, whichever you choose.
Madam Speaker, I think I said quite clearly that there is a story going around which I heard, and that I'm repeating the story here, but I intend to corroborate it. I think I said so specifically, Madam Speaker. So I shall move on. Madam Speaker, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this. I really thought I ought to deal with some of these matters because they impacted on my own credibility by virtue of what was said and the fact that I am now the minister with responsibility for the NDC dealing with cleaning up something which is really requires a lot of work. I don't want to stay on that line for very long, but I do wish to cover a few matters, because I know it's getting late and there are a number of other speakers, and I really want to allow the public to have an opportunity to go and rest. It's work tomorrow for some people. The Prime Minister's budget and his theme of protecting vulnerable citizens in the face of a global recession. I think this is very important. We heard a lot of noise coming from the opposition benches on the matter of government putting a committee together to review the modalities with respect to dealing with public assistance. And everybody imputed political motives and so on. But let's face it. The reason why we need, there are something like 3,600 people or thereabouts, maybe even 4,000 on public assistance. And I know that just prior to the last elections, a number of people found themselves on public assistance, some of whom shouldn't have been there. And what the government recognizes is that there are situations where sometimes dead people are collecting money, people who don't exist, people who traveled overseas 20 years ago and so on, somebody's collecting. And government has decided that while these people are collecting, other persons who deserve to get that money, they're not getting it. In my own constituency, in the 2.5 years that we're there, that's in, well, 2.5 years since election, I've not been able to get one person on the list. Not one. And I've sent numerous names. Nobody pays any attention to it. Nobody comes and visits the people. I understand that the office in the South is undermanned, so perhaps that may be where some of the difficulty lies. But there seems to be a great deal of difficulty moving people from the list, checking them out, rationalizing their presence on the list, and removing them if they don't deserve. So government took a decision to look at the whole thing. This is an inclusive policy, an inclusive decision. It's a decision to bring a level of sanity to something which is currently insane. And the reality is that if cabinet decides that it's going to put a committee in place, it's not a committee of the cabinet. It is not a committee of the cabinet. It's not cabinet members. It's a committee of persons working in the Ministry of Health, persons working in the Ministry of Social Services, church leaders and so on, who are going to come together to rationalize the list. This is what it's all about. I don't see anybody out there who wouldn't welcome something like that unless they are fearful that some of the people who they have put on the list who do not deserve to be there will be taken out. That's the only reason for having a problem with that. No other reason. And so I had difficulty when a prime minister and minister of finance, in his attempt to protect vulnerable citizens in the face of the global recession, is faced with all sorts of contradiction and, you know, charges of playing politics and so on, when all we want to do is clean the list so that we can put poor people who deserve to be there on the list. And many of them I know do in fact deserve to be there. So I thought I would touch on that because I think that's important. I heard the member for Cassie East constantly harping about some allocation in the budget. I think he's right. But I think I've dealt with that before, but he continues to repeat it because it sounds good to the ears of those who want to pay attention to that sort of thing. And he refers to a line item within the budget 2 years ago talking about China making a certain allocation. But sometimes, you know, when these guys attempt to, or I should say members opposite attempt to mislead, they run into trouble. Because he spoke about there being an item in there for the Chinese, that the Chinese were putting. I don't know who put that in there. Obviously the person who prepared the budget, but clearly not in collaboration with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, because I wasn't in possession of anything of that nature, neither had I ever seen it. But in speaking to that particular line item, he made an error in that he admitted that if this government was interested in grassroots projects, all it had to do was to ask the Chinese government to entertain grassroots projects. So it immediately struck me that the reason they want grassroots projects, according to them, is because they didn't see a necessity to ask for it. The very same people who proposed to be the government of the Malawi, the government of the poor, the government of the dispossessed, were interested only in looking at the white elephant projects and had no interest in footpaths. And yet they come here in this honorable house and talk about people having to bring two shoes, one to go through the mud and another one when they get by the side of the road. But they made no attempt whatsoever to ask for the grassroots projects that they said would have been available if they asked for them. Nothing. How do you accept that? Is that generosity of spirit? You know, we The Taiwanese never, they don't bring down workers in to do a project. They hire solutions. And not only did the Chinese bring down their own workers, but what they did was they said, in China, you don't get $100 a day, brother. So you're not getting $100 a day here. So in truth and in fact, wages in this country were brought back 10 years to facilitate the expectations of the Chinese masters. But we care about workers in St. Lucia. You know, sometimes we must be careful, because I wish that they had taken some Chinese money for grassroots projects, because then I would have less footpaths to build. But worse than that, there's this constant attack of the Taiwanese. Where does that come from? Mr. Chu, may his blessed heart rest in peace. His heart, not his soul. His heart, not his soul. That's right. Don't worry, I know they're sending for reinforcements, but we'll go on. You know, look at what's happening to St. Lucia. Plant projects. Don't worry, he'll be replaced. Look at it. Fisheries projects, aquaculture. All of these things that the Minister of Agriculture is going to speak about. Meat processing plants. I don't want to steal the Minister's thunder. Give him a chance. Let him say his thing. But one thing I will say is that with all of that, you can't fool St. Lucians. St. Lucians are seeing it. And they know that what they're seeing today is infinitely better than what they had yesterday. They know that. They can see it. They can feel it. It's impacting on their lives on a daily basis. And after this government goes and spends millions of dollars to refurbish the stadium so that the minister can host the games, a very successful project, they want to compliment us and try and steal some credit by saying, well, it's a Chinese stadium. You know, I mean, where are we going? Where are we going with that? And you know who fixed it? The Taiwanese. And you know who's fixing the psychiatric hospital? And not only just giving you a building, but they're doing the grounds and they're retrofitting. Because the Chinese didn't want to do grounds. They said, I'll do a building for you, you do the grounds. Taiwanese are doing the grounds. Furniture. The Chinese are giving you an empty building. They put in furniture and equipment. You understand? Yeah, we had to do it. There's a $4 million wall. And just because the Chinese were here, the idea, Great Wall of China, $4 million of taxpayers' money. When other people were proposing that they were better fight because of the movement in the ground and so on. And we want to vilify the Taiwanese. This is what we're all about. Let me say something to you. You know, I'll be visiting Taiwan soon. And I'll be back for those who would wish me not to be back. And when I come back, I'm going to have good news. I'll look for a twin. So you'll have Choo Choo. You understand? But we're going to move on. And you know, let not your heart be troubled. There is a new camaraderie that is being established between the Taiwanese and the Chinese. Now at the end of the day, I think we'll have both. It's just a matter of time. And all I can say to you is that this government has never expelled any foreign embassy or any foreign government. We have only taken the liberty and the new exercise our right to choose whomever we wanted. But we never ran after anybody. In fact, I understand there are Chinese in the house or in the embassy still here today, even while they don't have diplomatic relations with St. Lucia. But we're not after them. We're not trying to tell them get out. We're not locking doors on them, like some people did. We don't put in chains. We're doing nothing of that sort. You know, because this is a government that expresses itself in a gingerly, sophisticated, and classical manner. This is what we want to do. This is what we want to do. So there's no rough edges about this government. You know, we smooth our edges so that we can move forward and work in the interest of the people. So what I will ask from members opposite and from all St. Lucians is that in this turbulent time, as I wind up, in this turbulent time, let us see what we can do to come together. Let us embrace this budget. Let us seek to generate growth, no matter how small. Let us secure the jobs of St. Lucians and try to generate even more jobs. The NDC is working on that. We're looking as much as possible. It's not easy out there. Nobody's spending. Nobody can even get money to spend. But we're working at it. Let us understand that we're facing an unprecedented global crisis. And let us put our heads to the grindstone and cooperate with each other in an effort to ensure that the ship of state, even while delivered to us with one engine out of four working, that we are going to be able to repair the others and navigate these turbulent waters with our Prime Minister at our helm, leading us from one victory, no matter how small, to the next, until we add it all up, and cumulatively, it becomes one big victory, not for us, but for all of St. Lucia. I thank you.